If you have been given by the Lord a mind that can kind of absorb facts and retain them well, and I think I was just given one of those as a gift, and then the ability to articulate those things, and I was given that pretty much as a gift, then you've got a commodity that's in high demand in the evangelical church in America. You can teach. It can exist completely independent of any intimacy with God, and yet it can be very highly valued in the church. So to have, a what would appear to be a flourishing life as a Christ follower in the context of the American church is one thing. But and by the way, I think one of the greatest things I've observed, especially I'm in my mid-60s now, especially over this last decade, is how much God is not embarrassed by how long it took me to get here. And I'm super grateful for that, right? So I'm really trying to set down shame as it might relate to where I was 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, kind of thing. I just don't think that has any value in understanding things.
Hey guys, as part of our Stories of Transformation, I am really pumped right now to be able to bring to you David Conrad. David is a recent friend of mine over the last couple of years. It's interesting. One of the beautiful things about being in the body of Christ is to be able to meet people from around the world and to immediately have an affinity with them, for them. And that's definitely true with this brother. So I'm excited to bring his story to you guys today. Dave, we're just going to jump right in, man. I would love to just hear, what would it have been like to have a bird's eye view into your relationship with the Lord, over the last however long you've been a Christian?
As I look back, I think I was trying to prove to everyone, including God, that I deserve to be in his kingdom. And when you and I first got to know each other and you talked about, what most evangelicals think about what God thinks of them, the word disappointment just super resonated with me. And that had actually come into my mind, into some focus before we even met each other, Nathan, that, I remember having kind of nasty thoughts and dreams about things that you just ought to engrave on my headstone. He's a disappointment. And I'm aware that I have been given some wonderful gifts by the Lord. I take no credit for them, but just to speak the truth, I've been given a nice intellectual gift and a community that could flourish in and whatnot, and worked for a American university for 25 years in the middle of my career. And it was an environment that really sort of encouraged and flourished in that kind of giftedness. But it did nothing to say that I had value apart from what I could do for you. And as I was kind of in these recent years, kind of really trying to do the hard work of reevaluating my own journey and how does that shape my perspective on things, and to really come to a clear understanding that my own journey as a young person, what have you, to try to broker kind of a peaceful environment in my home growing up, and then to be responsible to sort of manage a series of ceasefires so that the family could still function, I think wove into me this notion that to the extent that I can solve your problems, I have value, and created what a dear friend and therapist that I have talked with and worked with in my life said was a profoundly externally focused identity, that I felt good about myself to the extent that I could perceive that you felt good about me. And there was nothing else in that equation. It's like I didn't get a vote in that. It was just what I perceived. It's sort of radical codependence at one level, when you get right down to it.
So here, David is definitely correctly diagnosing this, that a radical codependence. Yet what he's highlighting is the fact that so many of us gain or draw our identity from what we can do. This is a deeply formed and habituated problem in our society, because this is actually the way that our society functions. Your value is directly linked to what you can provide for me. And so we've got to recognize that, like, the way of Jesus and the way that things actually are being pressed upon by a transactional society that's actually malforming us away from the way that we're designed.
I think God was really generous to me in that I was perceiving his grace, perceiving his faithfulness, perceiving a journey in sanctification and growing in him. But when Jeremiah says, let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, or the strong boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me. I think I was really long on understanding and really short on knowing. And I think that this last season has been this marvelous sort of awakening of what it is to know God in a relational sense, as opposed to knowing about him in a factual sense. And it hasn't attenuated the value of the knowledge or the understanding. It hasn't made that less valuable, but it has put it in a very different context, that there's nothing being proven. There's no certificate being earned in order to, or however you might, you know, finish that sentence kind of thing. So it's been a radical sort of transition going forward, that this notion that originally I start with a overarching feeling that God's likely disappointed. I gave you all these gifts and this is all you could do with it kind of thing. It was the perspective, to now actually believing that, like, once in a while, though, I'm a lay elder at our church. Once in a while, they rotate me into the preaching rotation. And one of the beautiful repercussions of this last journey was when I walk off the platform after preaching, I've learned to spend a moment just absorbing God's gratitude for my utility to him, instead of criticizing where I know I flubbed some word or screwed something up or what have you, but to actually experience his delight in me as his child, trying to introduce others to a Savior who loves them, and to stay in that space rather than go all into the assessment critical space, is an example of how that's had sort of a practical implication for me.
Okay, now we're getting to the point in David's story where you're starting to see a shift, right? He has this awareness that something is off. He begins to start to identify that, like, wait a minute, I've been malformed in some ways, some pretty significant ways that are affecting how I'm living my life and affecting my relationship with the Lord. And so what he starts to do is actually move toward God in relationship about those things. And that's so critical, because now instead of trying to manage his resume or do more things for God, now instead, even in his giftedness, he's taking those things to God in relationship to experience a deep identity affirmation from God instead of the things that he's doing. That is really, really important.
I was standing in the bathroom one morning, getting my, probably brushing my teeth or something like that, getting ready to start the day. And you're standing there in the mirror, so glad that no one in your acquaintance is there, you know, kind of thing. But God showed up and said, "Oh, that's the dude. That's the guy I made. And I'm not the least bit ashamed to do business with him." To be there in your just kind of profoundly vulnerable self, fortunately private, you know, but your profoundly vulnerable self, you can all kind of create the picture in your head of what that moment is like in the morning. You're shaving, you're brushing your teeth, whatever. And in that moment, God showed up. It strangely made my bathroom holy ground. And to be at my least impressive and have God say, "No, this is the guy. You know, I know how I made you. I did it with great, you know, forethought. And I'm ready to do business with you. I don't need you to perform. I don't need you to earn this or impress that or pass this test or whatever. I have things I want to do with you." I mean, it's not like I feel a release from his continuing work in my life. If anything, the intensity has gone up. But it's just the, you know, the cart's no longer before the horse, in a sense. It's no longer so as to earn, but because I've received kind of thing.
This is such a beautiful moment in David's story, that knowing him has made a profound impact on his life, as you guys are hearing. It actually reminds me of a conversation I had with Kurt Thompson one time, when Kurt said, "You know, we don't delight in God. We delight in the fact that God delights in us." And that's a really critical distinction, because I feel like so many people out there are know that they should delight in God. And so they're like, "Oh, I should delight in the Lord, but I don't." And it creates a lot of tension in people's interior lives. And I think that one of the keys in transformation is to get beyond that to recognize that the delight of God comes from, its origin is the reality that God delights in us, that he delights in you. And all you have to do to prove this, if you have kids, is just go delight in your kids and see what happens. Like the delight is absolutely there, but it's only there as we are delighting in them. And so really, really important distinction that David is highlighting here.
If step one in this journey was kind of awakening to a completely different relational dynamic between me and the God who saved me, if that's step one, step two is to recognize that I had constructed, and I'm going to borrow some of Eden's language here, I had constructed, well, I guess it even predated that, but a false self. And hanging out with some of my friends in the Eden Project has really added some interesting texture to this. The false self, I had created a version of myself that was optimized to impress others and to impress God, and thus earn friendship, relational positions, whatever, professional favor, whatever. But it was all about earning, not about being, kind of things. So there was an axiomatic or kind of pre-existing condition of insufficiency that had to be overcome by overachieving, sort of thing. It was sort of the context I was in. But I think there's something about how the human brain is made that as we learn language, and it allows us to understand things with greater clarity, and that all of a sudden now it's easier for us to address things and to make progress in areas because whatever that linguistic side of our brain is helps us organize that information in a way that allows us to work with it better. And I think just becoming aware of this whole, what is a false self and what is its both its damage and frankly, what is its utility in protecting us while we're still trying to figure out how to navigate life?
Okay, got to stop here just for a second because that was just an awesome commercial for Eden Resources. So we have a ton of resources for you guys. You can check them out at theedenproject.com/resources. What David's talking about is the mission of the resources arm of Eden Project, which is give them a new paradigm to think about these things, which will allow and give them space for deeper relationship and intimacy with themselves, with others, and ultimately with God.
This forward progress following kind of an awakening of understanding God's love has been to find enough quiet in my life to create a safe place for me to do the inward work to say, no, what really is going on in my heart? And I think one of the interesting discoveries of my latter years is that I think, and I've been a part of this, I think that we have done the Christian church a great disservice in acting like because salvation is by faith alone through grace alone, or by grace alone through faith alone, and all of that, which is absolutely true and fabulous, we make it sound like there's no effort involved. But in point of fact, there is significant effort involved. And for me, I have to provide quiet times. You know, we use the term solitude and silence, but I have to provide chunks of time for me to let the noise quiet down. One of my favorite stories, Nathan, when I was an undergraduate, I was studying engineering in Southern California, and the university I was going to had what they call an anechoic chamber, and it's a huge room with giant foam blocks on the walls. I mean, 4 feet deep pyramids of foam, and you go in this room, and they close this door that's, 5 feet thick and what have you, and after you've been in there for about 5 minutes, you can hear the valves of your heart open and close. You can hear the sound of your breathing sounds like a torrent. And you hear all kinds of things you become aware of going on in your body that you couldn't hear until you had been in the quiet. And you had to be in the quiet for a while. My first reaction to that is I was astonished that my ears were still capable of hearing things that quiet, that the noise I experienced in day-to-day life hadn't made my ears incapable of it. That was the first thing. But the second thing was this, wow, all of this stuff is happening down there. And so that little experience I had, 40 years ago as an undergraduate, there's a spiritual parallel to that, that I have to create a space that's quiet enough so I could finally hear. So my journey is more satisfying I mean, my journey of the Lord even saying hard things to me is more satisfying now. And there are hard things that he is doing for me. I am a lay elder at my church, and dealing with church stuff is just hard and messy and demanding on your soul. And you've got to be able to somehow put the Lord back in because life is sucking it out. And those processes, for me, require not that I perform better, but usually that I, you know, find a time to sit alone. And, you know, okay, this I certainly wouldn't project this on anybody else, but one of my sons, we have twin sons that are in their mid-30s, and one of them's, you know, turned me on to smoking a pipe, of all things. I don't know. I think it's probably my homage to C.S. Lewis or something. I don't know. Turns out that he liked a tobacco called Three Nuns. So I went and found that tobacco. They still make it, you know. But it takes me about a half an hour to gather up all my little kit and go and sit on my back porch outside and, you know, pack the pipe and light it and go through and keep it lit, you know, until it's out at 15 or 20 minutes. It's about a 30-minute exercise to do that. I deliberately don't take my phone with me. I don't take anything to read with me. It's an intentional 30-minute pause in everything else, so that maybe by minute 27, the noise is quieted down and I can hear my heart.
The practice that David is ascribing right now in silence and solitude is such a critical practice that very, very, very few people actually make time to listen to God. Even in prayer, most prayer practices are people talking to God about some kind of plot line in their life that has tension around it, and they're asking for resolution, and they're asking God for something, but rarely do we sit down and create space to actually listen to God. And this is for where David is in his story, this kind of practice has become really critical, because the Christian life is not about what we say to God primarily, but what he says to us. And unless we learn how to slow down and listen and approach God with confidence, then we're not going to be able to hear what he's saying to us.
We have not made it a practice of in any way systematically teaching the importance of that throughout our journey. I take great delight in helping people kind of understanding the arc and the flow of the history of the Old Testament. And I have taught, I don't know, sometimes 16 weeks, 20 weeks, I've taught, you know, surveys, the Old Testament, all this kind of stuff, and been through, you know, bazillions of facts. And never once in there does it occur to me to say how important it was that Jesus pulled his people into the wilderness, you know, so as to create a relationship with them. And to kind of look through that lens and then to use that as an opportunity to teach that. A friend of mine and I were teaching through the Old Testament. He had the best quote of the entire series when he was talking about the Exodus. He said, first God saved his people, and then he taught them how to be his people. I have a friend here in Huntsville, Alabama, named Gordon. Gordon, he and his wife have had incredible impact in world missions. He and his wife have traveled all over the world. They've never had a multi-year assignment overseas, but they've gone for like 6 months and here and 5 months there and 4 months there. And mainly because he is a genius at commercial construction. And so he's built, you know, 15 buildings to build a seminary in Uganda. And he's been in, you know, countries that we can't even name kind of things. He had a fascinating journey. His professional journey was that he taught in the trades. He taught carpentry and commercial construction and steel construction and things like that. And he said something to me the other day that has really stuck in my mind. He said, when I'm teaching at a trade school, I don't teach so that my students can know. I teach so that they can do. And in a few weeks, I have the responsibility of introducing the Sermon on the Mount at our church as preaching. And it's just fascinating to me to look through that lens that Gordon gave me and to think that, you know, nobody was sitting on the mount with an iPad taking notes or a voice recorder recording it or even writing anything down as if those kind of tools were available. No, the purpose of that teaching was to transform the way people lived, not to give them more knowledge that they could be puffed up by or share or anything else. Jesus was trying to change them into people that felt at home in his kingdom, I think was the purpose of the Sermon on the Mount. And so this notion that that I'm trying to grow out of a mode of aggregating facts and into a mode of deepening a connection is sort of what the season is. I'm still figuring out what my version of spiritual disciplines are that match what the Lord's trying to do in me. The notion that my pace and practice for my season right now might have more to do with sitting on my porch with nothing, because the aggregation of more knowledge isn't the key. It's the implementation of living in a relationship that is kind of what my need is, not to learn more facts.
So the way that David is talking about his relationship with the Lord is really common among those who have taken a very deliberate, slowing inward journey to discover really, what is the spiritual life? Who is God? Who am I? What is this all about? And one of the main things that happens in that journey is a paradigm shift from, I need to know more and do more, to basically, hey, how, like, while the knowledge and the activity is important, the knowledge and the activity is not an end unto itself, but a means to deeper intimacy and relationship with God. And so you shift from knowing and doing primarily to using the knowing and doing it in order to cultivate intimacy with the Lord. So it shifts from doing things for God to actual God himself. And that is a really, really critical shift.
There's the stuff that I'm really walking away from with intentionality, that God is not sitting there scoring my performance today and deciding whether or not a relational investment in me is worth the return on investment. You know, he's not in that space. But I think in my head, there's this middle ground where he says, what Jesus did on the cross covered your sins. It's almost like the last part of that sentence is, so I'm willing to forgive you. You know, that's not the same thing as what Jesus did was so comprehensive that I actually delight in being with you. And so one of the things that Dan, again, spiritual director, and I have talked about a good bit is that scene, I think it's near the end of the book of John, where Jesus is on the beach, the guys are kind of discouraged, we're post-resurrection, and they're out fishing because they got no idea what else to do, kind of thing. They didn't catch any fish. They kind of come in, how's your fish? And, oh, no, you didn't catch anything. Go back out and try the other side. They still haven't figured out it's Jesus. Of course, I love the story. They catch all the fish, and then Peter realizes, you know, it's Jesus, and he jumps in the water. You know, this notion of having the joyful experience of sitting on the beach, sharing a meal with Jesus, and he's got nothing better to do than that, is a really profound thought. And it's very different than that middle space where his substitutionary atonement is sufficient, right? You almost go into mathematical language when you talk about that. But to recognize that understanding that is not valueless, but it's in order that we might sit on a beach with our butt in the sand and laugh together and, I don't know, grill fish together or whatever, you know, in that particular context. But so I think that what this journey has been is to push past the scoring God. And I'm still working past the, I think I'll put up with you, God. Yeah. And occasionally experience the, isn't it great to sit on the beach together, God?
What we're starting to hear from David now is the transformation of his God image. Through his inward journey, he has learned to identify areas of his image of God that are wounded, and also identify areas of his false self where he's defending against insecure relational patterns. And he's beginning to experience his true self, vulnerable, exposed, real, drenched in joy, able to sit by Jesus next to a fire on a beach.
It's been interesting. My wife Jane and I have really been on an interesting journey. When the Lord awakens you to things like this, you immediately want to shake everyone around you and say, no. But you realize, no, the Lord has his own path and pace and sequence and everything else. But it is transformative. but it's learning something new. And it takes a while before it is the way we think. When I was a young engineer, I had a boss named Gerard. Gerard was a profoundly gifted mathematician. And I've never been a great mathematician, but he was a profoundly gifted one. And we were working on some stuff inside how a big radar works together. And to watch him apply some really complex mathematics to how to problem solve in the context of what you're trying to design in this radar was just amazing to watch. And I got to learn later that Gerard's parents were both professors of mathematics and that he just kind of grew up in an environment where it was very natural for him to assimilate these tools to the point where doing sophisticated, what we call digital signal processing, was as complex to him as a screwdriver is to me. And I think I'm still very much on the journey of this awareness of God and his, as you said, his benevolence, his love towards me. I'm still awakening to that, but it's something that I have to remind myself of. You know, it's still a new thing I'm learning.